morning. I'm Allison Ruttenberg, 17497, counsel for Mr. Hyder. I was initially appointed by the ABC quite a number of years ago when Mr. Hyder's 35C was pending, and then I did the appeal to denial of 35C. I continued to represent him pro bono in 2011 when he found out that his sentence had been ex parte extended for a year without any notice to him, without the opportunity for hearing, and without appointment of counsel. So I have been pro bono on this case since 2011, trying to find Mr. Hyder a remedy. It's undisputed that he is now unconditionally discharged from his sentence and has been so for over a year now. When the Boulder County District Court ex parte and unilaterally extended his sentence by 1 year of mandatory parole in 2011, you know, he has fully discharged that additional year sentence. The Attorney General is urging this court to just dismiss this appeal because it's moot, because this was a 35A motion contending that sentencing him retroactively 10 years after the fact to a new sentence without the opportunity to be heard, without notice, without appointment of counsel, that it's all moot because he's now discharged his sentence. I'm urging the court to go ahead and hear the merits and issue a ruling on some of these issues, because too many prisoners are left without a remedy in a situation like this. You know, in this case, I first went to the Colorado Supreme Court on a Rule 21 petition because I thought that would be the fastest way maybe to get Mr. Hyder some relief. The Supreme Court sat on a Rule 21 petition for almost 2 months. That's a very long time for them to consider a Rule 21 petition without making a ruling, but it was ultimately denied. And then I did go back to the district court on a Rule 35A motion. And what we're talking about here is only a year sentence. And even in the cases expedited in front of the Court of Appeals, the court, it's just not possible to file a Rule 35 motion, get a ruling on it, do an appeal of it, have that all take place in only 10 months. Because a year sentence with earned time and everything, as a practical matter, means only an additional 10 months. So there's too many prisoners that are being left without a remedy when this situation continues to happen. And this is not a unique situation. It's not, it doesn't happen every day or every month, but it happens quite frequently. And it's happened with more frequency since the murder of Tom Clements. After the murder of Tom Clements, the DOC has gone back in now and done an audit on all of the prisoners' sentences, and they're sending emails out to numerous courts questioning the sentences on numerous prisoners, questioning.
Pardon me for interrupting, Ms. Ruttenberg. Does the record below reflect what you've just told us?
It doesn't. These are all just public policy reasons why this court should reach the merits here, because in situations like
but,
this.
But isn't, haven't you just asserted a factual question about what DOC is doing since Mr. Clements' murder?
Your Honor, if the court feels that more findings of fact need to be made on public policy issues and issues of mootness, then I would urge the court to remand back to the Boulder District Court so an evidentiary hearing could be held on some of these issues, because I think this case does present very important public policy considerations, which is why this court should hear the merits. At the very least, and this is in the record here, we have a district court judge who, just on the basis of an email from the DOC questioning the prisoner's sentence, unilaterally and ex parte resentenced him without appointment of counsel, without notice, without the opportunity to be heard, and resentenced him on the date after which his sentence was fully the first sentence was fully discharged. So there's four different reasons why the Boulder County District Court may have been in error. And even if the only issue is appointment of counsel or the ability to be heard on the resentencing, this court should issue an order on the merits. It just violates notions of fundamental fairness and justice to allow a court to unilaterally and ex parte and retroactively, 10 years after the fact, resentence a prisoner and extend his prison sentence by a year. even if the original sentence was a mistake. This isn't the situation where there was some sort of Scrivener's error on the minimus, there was some sort of a typo, there was some sort of a mistake. At the original sentencing hearing, there was a great deal of debate as to whether Mr. Heyer should be sentenced to mandatory parole. And after a hearing where all parties were heard and the district attorney even conceded, maybe incorrectly, but the district attorney conceded that mandatory parole didn't apply, Judge Sandstead ordered an 11-year sentence with no mandatory parole. And then 10 days before the expiration of Mr. Heyer's sentence, 11 whole years later, then the DOC asked a different judge in the Boulder County District Court to retroactively change his sentence.
Do you agree that the original sentence was incorrect and the change that was ultimately made was the sentence that should have been in place initially?
I am unwilling to concede that because the state of the law in effect at the original sentencing hearing, that wasn't clear at all. And so I think that's another reason why Judge Mulvihill should have held a hearing before retroactively ordering Mr. Heyer to be sentenced to 1 year of mandatory parole. If that had all happened in today's world after the Hall opinion came down in 2003, that's probably what would have happened. But in this case, everybody agreed that mandatory parole didn't apply. Then the district attorney did not appeal to the Court of Appeals.
Right, but agreement doesn't mean they were right. I mean, people oftentimes stipulate to committing error consciously or not.
Well, and if an error was committed here, since everybody was not in an agreement that an error was committed here, that's a reason why Judge Mulvihill should have held a hearing rather than just ex parte extending his sentence for a year without notice and an opportunity to be heard. My biggest issue was with what Judge Mulvihill did was that he did it the day after November 28, 2011. November 28, 2011 was the date that Mr. Heyer's 11-year sentence was unconditionally discharged. So what Judge Mulvihill did was, after that sentence was discharged, then retroactively sentenced him to an additional year of parole. I don't think that Judge Mulvihill had jurisdiction to do that the date after Mr. Heyer's sentence was unconditionally discharged, and I cited some authority. I realized that there's not a lot of authority in the Colorado state courts directly on point, but that's another reason why this court should consider the merits of this case. The public policy considerations and the implications of this case are just too great to just dismiss it as moot. Otherwise, prisoners like Mr. Heyer are left without a remedy. I mean, what happened to Mr. Heyer was he was expecting to be unconditionally discharged. He had made all of his arrangements, and then on the eve of his discharge, he said, just kidding, your sentence has been retroactively, or you've been retroactively resentenced now to an additional year. And he had no opportunity to defend himself, to make arguments as to why the original sentence was correct, and this all happened on the day after which he should have been unconditionally discharged. You know, I would like to reserve the rest of my time unless the court has any additional questions for me.
Okay. We're good. Thank you.
May it please the court, I'm Christine Brady, registration number 24779, representing the people. The people's position is that this case is moot and it should be, the appeal should be dismissed. The sentence is served and it's a sentencing issue, so there's no relief that can be granted to the defendant. Regarding the merits, on a 35A motion, the trial court can sua sponte correct an illegal sentence at any time. And I know one of the things alleged in this case is that the prosecutor should have been responsible for filing a 35A, the DOC should not have gotten involved, but the bottom line is if the sentence is illegal The trial court can correct it at any time, and it doesn't matter who alerts the trial court as to the fact that the sentence is illegal.
And Ms. Brady, I understand that Rule 35A says that, but let me ask you a couple of questions. Let's just say hypothetically, for purposes of discussion, we conclude that it's not moot because we go to one of the exceptions.
Okay.
Let's say that's where we are. Normally, on filing on illegal sentences, normally a motion gets filed, goes into court, both parties argue about it, and there's an opportunity for one side to say, well, hold on a minute, the sentence in this case was either legal or not, and then the court can make a call. Shouldn't we be concerned here about this sort of outside of court business where literally on the eve of this man's release, the court is notified of a potentially illegal sentence, and the court acts on its own without saying, hey, look, I got this email. Shouldn't we have a hearing about this? Come on down. Let's talk. Why isn't that the proper way this should proceed? Because obviously, Mr. Heyer had a very real interest in whether or not he was going to be under the custody of the Department of Corrections for another year. And this did change the sentence that he was serving on the eve of his release. Because as Mrs. Ruttenberg says quite accurately, at that point he's thinking, I'm done, it's over. And in fact, he's been told, I'm done, it's over.
That's correct, Your Honor. And it probably is the better practice that even though it would make absolutely no difference, for instance, in this case, a hearing would not have made any difference at all, it's probably the better practice for the court to allow the parties to weigh in on this. In this case, I don't think there's proper grounds for addressing the case on the merits, because regardless of whether there was a hearing or not, the result would have been the same. And I disagree with the defense that there's some kind of pattern here and that the courts are willy-nilly just reviewing sentences and deciding to resentence defendants without a hearing.
But again, Ms. Brady, the record doesn't include below facts to support either the presence or the absence of a pattern. Isn't that correct?
That's correct.
And counsel, regardless of whether there is or isn't a pattern, what about the possibility that this is a situation that's capable of repetition, but it's evading our review again because by the time it gets to us, somebody's already served their sentence. Maybe not Mr. Heyer himself, or somebody that's in the same scenario. So why doesn't that exception to mootness apply here?
Well, that's true. I just think that these are not the right facts to overcome the mootness test, because in fact there would have been nothing that the parties could have argued. And if there is a pattern, I'm not aware of it. And that would be a pattern of trial courts not conducting a hearing when a hearing was necessary. Is there no further questions? Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Ruttenberg, you have 6 minutes and 23 seconds.
Thank you. What the Attorney General is effectively arguing is we can ignore the Sixth Amendment right to counsel, we can ignore the Fifth and the 14th Amendment rights to due process if it won't make any difference anyway. That constitutional rights do not have to be respected by the district court if the outcome doesn't matter anyway. And if that's true, then why do we have sentencing hearings in habitual offender cases? Because the sentence is mandated by the habitual offender statute. There's no discretion by the district court to either increase or decrease. It's mandated by statute. The same thing happens in a first-class felony case where no death penalty is sought. If there's a conviction of a first-class felony, the sentence of an adult offender is automatically imposed. So if the Attorney General is correct, we can just dispense with sentencing hearings in all of those cases because we know what the result's going to be ahead of time, and we don't have to go through the time, trouble, and expense of appointing counsel for these defendants, taking up docket time to hold hearings for a sentencing hearing. That is not the correct result. The Constitution is never optional, and the district court if the district court is going to resentence the defendant and increase his sentence, whether the district court thinks that the that there's no discretion one way or the other, the district court must give the defendant an opportunity to be heard. At the very minimum, make a proportionality argument under the Eighth Amendment and make a sentencing arguments to the court. In this case, and the Attorney General continues to ignore this rather pesky little fact here, and that is Judge Mulvihill did not retroactively resentence this defendant to what might have been the legal sentence that should have been imposed 11 years ago. He did not do that until November 29, 2011. Mr. Heyer discharged that first sentence on November 28, 2011. Did Judge Mulvihill have jurisdiction on November 29, 2011 to retroactively resentence Mr. Heyer? That issue is before this court, and I urge this court to rule on the merits, because that does make a very big difference in this case. That would not render this case moot, because then that additional year that Mr. Heyer spent was illegal. And if he has any type of civil remedies, he can then pursue them.
May I ask you a clarifying question, though? By using the November 29th date, you're talking about a date that there was the actual signature placed on the document, and then it was not nunc pro tunc. But there was also, prior to Mr. Heyer's discharge, an amended minimus that was issued, and the court had made a written notation on the document in the file indicating that it was in fact going to change the date. Is that not
no,
correct?
No, Your Honor. There is no amended minimus dated November 23rd, 2011. That's the phantom fact in this case. The Attorney General keeps referring to an amended minimus on November 23rd, 2011. It does not exist. The only thing that happened on November 23rd was Judge Mulvihill made a handwritten note saying the sentence shall be changed.
Right.
But that it wasn't actually changed in November till November 29, 2011. That is when Judge Mulvihill entered the sentencing order. Nothing happened on November 23rd, 2011. And the notation on CourtLink that there was an amended minimus is incorrect, because there is no such document in the file whatsoever. And the government, with regards to these CourtLink entries, you know, wants to have it both ways. In cases where, you know, they want the CourtLink entries to be the rule of the case, to say, well, we have to go by the CourtLink entries, those are always accurate. And then in other cases, they'll argue, well, CourtLink is notoriously inaccurate. Mistakes are made all the time. In this case, there is no document in the file showing that there was any sentencing order on November 23rd, 2011. Judge Mulvihill simply did not amend or resentence Mr. Heyer until November 29th, 2011, even though he stated his intention to do so 6 days earlier. Now, you know, what if this had been a case where, you know, 5 years down the road, 6 years down the road, during this audit that happened after Tom Clement's murder, the DOC had decided, well, you know what, we really shouldn't have released Mr. Heyer way back on November 28th, 2011. He owes us another year. Let's go pick him up and make him serve that other year. First, we'll go into the Boulder County District Court and have him resentenced retroactively. After he's been fully discharged from a sentence, after he's been walking around on the streets for 5 years.
Isn't that, in fact, that is happening now? There's a well-publicized case, I believe, where there is somebody who was released erroneously and then had to go back, and that's one of the things that's being litigated now.
That's one of the things that's being litigated now.
I guess my question is, there are unfortunate circumstances that occur when these errors are made. I recognize that, but does that mean then that if there is an error that's made, the court should not address the error?
My argument is the court lost jurisdiction to address the error at midnight, November 28, 2011. And in this other well-publicized case, I'm sure that if he has competent counsel, they're making that argument too. The court loses jurisdiction to correct even an arguably illegal sentence once the prisoner has been fully discharged from that sentence. And that is part of the error that happened in this case, because there is no document that the government can point to in the file where Mr. Heyer was actually resentenced prior to November 28th, 2011. There's just that notation from Judge Mulvihill that he intends to do so in the near future. And I see I'm out of time unless the court has any additional questions.
Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Ruttenberg. Counsel, thank you very much. We appreciate your courtesy today. The case will stand submitted and an opinion will issue in due course.